Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For years, Tulsan Randa Warren has been helping both novice and experienced wine drinkers find the perfect wine for any occasion. Warren is one of 249 wine professionals worldwide to earn the title Master Sommelier from the Court of Master Sommeliers, and one of only 25 women with this distinction. She's a certified wine educator who's taught classes on wine here in Tulsa and to groups nationwide. Now she's distilled that information into a new book. 60-Minute Wine Expert, Taste Wine the Master's Way, offers basic information on a wide range of topics and a handy pocket guide size. Grape varieties and quick food pairings, practice tastings for wine and reds with comparison exercises, basics on wine etiquette, glassware, storage, and much more. There'll be a book launch and wine tasting this Friday evening at Magic City Books, one at 7 o'clock and another at 8:15. The tasting is free with the purchase of the book. Her book is also available at Amazon. She joins us today to talk about wine here on Studio Tulsa. Randa Warren, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich. I'm delighted to be here.
How did you get introduced to wine yourself? Was it a habit you picked up in your household as you were growing up, or was it something you discovered later in life?
I was driven to drink at an early age, but my mother forced me to take piano for 10 years as a child, and I did not like it. But no, we didn't have a lot of wine like the French do growing up. But basically, I went through college just drinking as everyone did, and graduated from college, started getting to my upper 20s, going to Bunko and things. And really, our go-to then was box wine, as it is today for many people, because it's so simple. I mean, you buy it, it's in the refrigerator, it tastes good. But as I started moving into more, you know, advanced social circles, I guess you could say, I really felt like I needed to know a little bit more about wine just so I wouldn't appear like a dummy.
Well, you write in the foreword, it says, you know, I go eat at a restaurant, and it was always such an ordeal to order wine because you always felt like, am I being taken advantage of? Am I getting good information? Am I ordering properly? Was that the motivating force for you?
It truly was, because you know, I was getting ready to be married, and we would be dining at restaurants or at little parties, and I thought, there's just got to be a way I can learn a little bit about wine. So I started buying a few wine books, and they would say, well, if you want to learn more about wine, you could try this, or you could call this person or that. And I ended up calling a company in New York, which is still there today, called the International Wine Center. Absolutely a wonderful place to learn about wine, and you do it as a home study program. So, but back then in Tulsa, there really wasn't anywhere to learn about wine. So I got the name of the International Wine Center in New York, had them send me the introductory program, and I kind of raced through it very quickly because they said Doug Frost, who's a master of wine and a master sommelier, would be in Tulsa in 4 weeks' time, and he could give me my test. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I better get cranking. So I raced through the book. I, you know, studied as hard as I could. And Doug Frost, who's literally one of four people in the world with those credentials, came and sat in my kitchen. I knew next to nothing about wine, and gave me my little exam. And I passed the test. And I think I got a B. It wasn't anything remarkable, that's for sure. And a few days later, the International Wine Center called, and they said, well, you passed your test, and we have the second level exam will be given in New York in 4 weeks' time, and we wondered if you might be able to step up to that challenge.
So you were just going from learning about wine to taking the path of becoming a master sommelier.
Exactly. And it was, when I look back, it's just mind-blowing because all I wanted, Rich, was to learn
to know how to order
at
a restaurant.
A little bit about wine and how to order wine. So now I'm starting to get kind of nervous because this is serious. I have now 4 weeks to go through a much thicker book and fly to New York, which I coincidentally just happened to be going to New York that weekend with my daughter in early December for shopping and the Rockettes. And so I said, well, okay, I'll try to do it. Oh, my God, I got into that book, and I got to the subject of pruning grapevines. And I would reread it and reread it. And we didn't have the internet back then, so I couldn't Google, could you explain more about double Gio pruning? And plus, I would be reading at night. It would put me to sleep. And I'd get up the next day, go through it all again. And I really worked hard. And I went to New York to take the test. And I passed, and I made an A. So I did very, very well, surprisingly, with that short period of time. Then, I'm not kidding you, a week later, they contacted me and they said, we really need to know by January 1st if you are going to go on to the 2-year program that starts in January. And I just said, oh my goodness. And it became a why not? I've already done level 1 and 2. Why not launch into this third level? So I then began that 2-year study program. Now, keep this in mind. This was not the sommelier program. This was more on the track to become a master of wine. But regardless,
is that more like a winemaker?
Well, no. You've got master of wine, which, again, there's just a handful in the world, maybe 250 also. But it deals a little bit more with the business of wine versus if you look at the Master Sommelier program, it's a little bit more, a lot more geared towards the service of wine.
And tasting and understanding how it works
with
food.
Well, they both deal extensively in tasting, mm-hmm. but the Sommelier program deals much more in the service of wine. So it's more for people in the restaurant service business, whether it's restaurants or wholesalers, distributors, retailers, and so on. So two different programs with a lot in common. So I managed to get through that as well. And then while I was up in New York being tutored, because the program started to get very difficult and I had to start going to New York to be tutored, I discovered that at the Culinary Institute of America, they were going to coincidentally be giving the introductory sommelier program while I was up being tutored with my friend Linda. I said, well, all right, I guess I could tutor with Linda on Thursday, rush up to Hyde Park Friday, Saturday, do that intro program, and be back to take my daughter to school Monday morning at Monte Cassino. So it all worked out very well, but I fell in love with the sommelier program. I just loved the whole aspect of it, and I was very fired up, and I took the intro course, I passed it, and then I went on for many years into testing for the higher levels, which in 2007, I finally passed the Master Sommelier test. So happiest day of my life.
What drove you to really learn that much if it was really about knowing enough to order wine in a restaurant? What became a passion about learning more than just that?
Well, I think one thing just leads to another. I mean, for instance, if you're dining out a lot and you know a little bit, say you read my book and you know a little bit more about ordering wine, you know a little bit more about the grape varietals and how to express what you actually like in a wine versus saying, well, I like it or I don't like it. It is nice to be able to verbalize a few basic things about the wine. But, aside from that, it just creates a little bit of a passion in you to know more. Well, I know about these grapes, but I know there's a whole lot of other grape varietals out there. I love California Red Zin, but I know there's some wonderful European wines that I've never perhaps had a chance to taste, and I'm a little scared to branch out. I hate to leave my comfort zone of the Lodi big explosive red Zinfandels and go and taste a more acidic Sangiovese. Because they're very drastically different. But what I hope to achieve in my book was to get people to think outside the box. There's a lot of great wine out there. Don't be stuck drinking the same one or two grape varietals the rest of your life.
So for somebody who's developing their palate, and I know a part of it is about teaching young people who are starting to drink wine how to figure out what areas of the world, what grape types of the world they're attracted to. So if you're looking at red and white, what are the sort of the essential parts of the world and the grapes that we should be looking at?
Well, and I don't want to scare anybody off. I mean, if you like wine and you're comfortable with drinking one or two types of wine, that there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying that if you open the box a little bit, you will bring in some, little surprises and you'll be actually pretty shocked. But I think people should start very slowly. I mean, you just don't want to go out and buy a case of European wine, because if you're not ready for European wine, you're probably not going to like that entire case of wine, and then you're going to be turned off. So we start, you know, very gradually. For instance, you mentioned Riesling a little bit earlier. You know, Riesling's also made in Washington State and many other places.
And it's very different than it would be in, say, Australia or New Zealand versus in Germany, for example.
Well, that's right. And so what I would say to you is you enjoy Riesling, German Riesling, or Washington State Riesling, but why don't you add a little exercise to your regimen and maybe try to find a Clare Valley Riesling from Australia, because they're absolutely stunning from that area. A little bit cooler climate. The soils really lend themselves to giving this wonderful backbone to the Riesling. Or perhaps trying an Austrian Riesling, which to me, every bit as good as Germany, in many facets a little bit better, and others maybe not, but well worth exploring. So just branching out a little bit, I think, makes the whole enjoyment of drinking wine a little bit more fun. You have something to look forward to. You have something to learn. You have something to share with your friends.
One of the things that can be a detriment to sort of branching out like that is the fact that, say, okay, you like Oregon Pinot Noirs. Okay, the next logical place to expand would be to go to Burgundy in France. Well, if you look at the top, you know, it's you're talking about down payments for major purchases to buy really fine French Burgundy. But I think the thought is, okay, if I just buy a Bourgogne Rouge, you know, sort of a house red from Burgundy, you know, first of all, it's not exactly cheap, and you don't know if it's any good unless you go out and experiment, I guess. So what is your advice for doing that branching out where you're not breaking the bank?
Well, that's an excellent question, because particularly in Burgundy or Bourgogne, you know, it's Pinot Noir is a finicky grape. It's difficult to grow. In Burgundy, the climate is a little bit cooler than we see over here in some of our Pinot growing areas like Russian River or Sonoma area. So the wines may not be as easy to like, but you don't need to get a really high-end Burgundy. What I tell people is, number one, research the vintage. Make sure that you're getting a wine from one of the better vintages. Just go online to winespectator.com, wherever, and just say current vintages in whatever area you're looking for, Burgundy or wherever. And you may see a remarkable difference. You may see 2013 may have an 87 rating, but 2014, 2015 may be rated as high as 94, 95. So your chances of getting a much better wine from the Burgundy area would be if you simply had that one clue as to the vintage, the better year to buy. If you have a favorite liquor store you go to, usually the people are very knowledgeable and they'll be able to direct you to the better vintage. And for heaven's sakes, you should always get that Vivino app, V-I-V-I-N-O, which you can take a picture of a wine and it'll just give you a quick review of it. And then there you have it. So again, you don't need to buy expensive wines from Europe or wherever, but having someone who can direct you to a good wine for a good price, I think is a key there.
My guest today is Randa Warren. She's a master sommelier here in Tulsa, and she's the author of the new book, 60-Minute Wine Expert, Taste Wine the Master's Way. It's a sort of a summation of what she's been presenting to numerous groups over the last decade or two, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, what would you say the essential piece of information from the book would be? Perhaps the practice tastings? You sort of give us ways to go through practice tastings or wine-food pairings. What would you say is the most essential part?
Well, I tried to cram so much into this book that I think it's hard to say there's just one essential theme other than to just bring a beginning wine taster up to speed or a more advanced taster, just to give some of the many tips that I have in the book. But the bottom line is love the wine you're with. You don't have to put on a bunch of pretenses and learn a bunch of snobbery adjectives dealing with wine. It's just a matter of holding your own when you are in an area with other wine lovers, and I think I just wanted people to be able to have a chance to learn about the basics of wine in a very short time in a fun and easy way. And that's really all I was trying to do.
You mentioned the terminology, and there is a lot of baggage that goes with, you know, people who are connoisseurs of wine. There's a lot of language that people who are not familiar with the language go, what are they talking about? How do you relate that in the book? You have some simple comparisons, say, take a Chardonnay versus a Sauvignon Blanc. And you say, okay, what are the differences? Here's some of the differences you should look for. Give us a sense of what you're trying to share with your readers.
Well, in that case, and if you would allow me to just expand very briefly on, say, the difference between Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc, many people drink both of them. They like both of them. But honestly, they don't really know why they like one more than the other. But when you break it down, the Chardonnay is a little bit heavier, a little bit more full-bodied. We get a little bit more, you know, more notes of apple, pear, and lemon. We often see French oak or oak used to age the Chardonnay, so you get a little bit of a baking spice element. And Chardonnay is often put through a second fermentation called malolactic, which gives the wine a buttery taste. Okay, so we put Chardonnay aside and we look at Sauvignon Blanc. Sauvignon Blanc's a little bit more refreshing because it's got this very lively acidity, high acid. We get notes of grassiness, a little jalapeno pepper and grapefruit, and almost a pungency associated with Sauvignon Blanc, almost like cat urine, if you will. I know it's kind of gross. Rich, you're making a face. But distinctively different than Chardonnay.
I think of the citrusy notes, too.
It's very citrus, that high lemon, the tart mm-hmm. ruby red grapefruit. So just knowing those characteristics, those descriptions of the wine, now armed with that knowledge in your head of the difference of the two grapes, you'll much more clearly be able to tell those two apart, especially if you do them in a blind setting, have someone pour a glass of each and twist them around and hand you a glass and say, okay, which is the Chardonnay, which is the Sauvignon Blanc? You'd be surprised. In a very short time, you'll be able to tell the difference. And that's called blind tasting.
Yeah. Those two examples of whites, they're very different. Sometimes reds can be fairly close together where it might be a little more difficult. What are some of the things you look for when you're doing blind tastings of red that sort of sniff out its pedigree, if you will?
Well, you know, white and red, I mean, they can be very, very difficult. I don't mean to oversimplify blind tasting. It's my biggest nightmare in life is someone will walk up and say, what's this? And I'll call it some crazy grape when it's Chardonnay or something. So that's every sommelier's, you know, our big fear. But reds, you know, they're similar, but once you start learning the difference in acidity and tannin and body and earthiness or fruitiness, earthiness versus fruitiness, then you can start to tear that wine down a little bit more. So what you think two wines that are very similar, once you start to break them down, then you'll see some differences. Now, if you have a straight Cabernet Sauvignon and you have a Cabernet Sauvignon blend, now that's much more difficult because you've got the same grape in both. But then you look at the blend and you say, wow, it's so much smoother and easier to drink and it doesn't have as much tannin. That's that characteristic in the wine that dries your tongue and, you know, makes your mouth, gives it a very dried out, fuzzy feeling on your tongue. Then you can start to say, okay, now I can tell the difference in the straight Cabernet because it's a much bigger style. It gives me that fuzzy feeling on my tongue a little bit more, whereas the blend is richer, softer, easier to drink. I think it's just knowing what you're looking for in wines, the basic components, as I mentioned, and then starting to break down your wines. Think about what you're tasting from time to time instead of just slugging it down. You know, I mean, we all do that after 8 at night, but from 6 to 8, think about what you're drinking.
What are the rules for, you know, what do you do to make sure you're serving wine at the proper temperature? Because it makes a big difference in how it tastes.
Well, it really does. And I've got a rule, I call it either the 20-20 rule or the 20-15 rule. It's basically, they're very similar, but the 20-20 rule is on white wines, I recommend that you pull them out of the refrigerator 20 minutes before you're going to serve them, so they're not so ice cold you can't taste or smell anything. Now, reds, I say put into the refrigerator 20 minutes before you're going to serve them. And that way, when you take that red wine out of the refrigerator after 20 minutes, it's going to taste a little more refreshing. The acid is, you know, actually going to be there. It's going to reduce that feeling of heavy, heavy alcohol in the wine. And you can actually make like a $15 Cabernet taste like a $30 Cabernet by simply refrigerating it for 15 or 20 minutes. So the 20-20 rule, I think it's a great tip.
Does it really make that big a difference in how it tastes?
It really does.
So if the red is too warm, it's just going to... You're going to taste the alcohol maybe a little more?
Well, if a red is too warm, and you certainly, as you said, in Oklahoma, we get this all the time. I can remember being in New York one time eating outside in the heat of the summer, and the red wine was so hot that we asked for an ice bucket for the red wine. And, of course, the waiter's jaw was, you know, quivering because he couldn't quite understand the whole concept. But we put that red wine into the ice bucket for, you know, like 7 or 8 minutes, pulled the wine out, poured it, and it drastically changed the taste of the wine. It just made it taste a lot better. It really was more refreshing. It was, the alcohol wasn't burning, you know, down the back of the throat. So makes a big difference. And honestly, 15 or 20 minutes is not that long. Now, if you were to keep it in for an hour, that's too cold, and you would literally have to let that wine sit out for probably 40 minutes to have it rest up.
So for those that are just new to wine, what are the basic things that you try to convey to somebody who is, they've had wine, they said, well, it's okay, I'm not sure if I like it better than beer or something else. What are the starting points that you like to point somebody out to, learn about wine?
Well, I think for beginning drinkers, and most beginning drinkers prefer a sweeter wine, right? So don't just go overboard and buy these really dry Cabernet Sauvignons or French Chablis, Chablis being the Chardonnay grape. Inch into it. Just have someone at your liquor store help you do a graduation of, say, 3 different sweetness levels. And each night, over 1 week's time, have a small glass or a big glass of each one and just start progressing your tasting. And I think that will go a long way. But force yourself to get away from the super, super sweet and go to just less sweet and then drink that for a while and then go to even less sweet. And before long, you will absolutely prefer a drier style of wine. And I think that's where most wines today
so that, that less sweet, what might be that less sweet for you? If you were recommending some.
Like the grape varietals?
Yeah.
Well, certainly on the sweeter end, we've got the Riesling, some of the Vouvray, which is Chenin Blanc, and of course some of your sweeter styles of champagne or sparkling wine. So I would say move towards California or New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs and Chardonnays, because they still have quite a bit of residual sugar, so there's still going to be some sweetness to them, but not as much as the Riesling.
So where do you move red, if you're wanting to learn red?
Well, start with the lighter varietals like Pinot Noir, because it's light. It's not going to have that fuzzy, tannic feeling you're going to get in your mouth. So start very light from California, and then maybe move up to a little heavier red wine, say Merlot. Again, from California. And then once you start to get comfortable, then start trying some of the European wines, like a Rioja, which is the Tempranillo grape, because many times they have a lot of fruit in them, but you'll also get the added benefit of a little bit of earthy taste to maybe it's leather or a little bit of a soil. You're reminded of the soil. And it only adds to the fun of a wine, so you don't feel like you're just drinking fruit all the time. You now have some more complexity, some other things you're tasting besides the fruit when you move into some more complex wines.
Randa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Randa Warren is a master sommelier and wine taster and the author of the new book, 60-Minute Wine Expert, Taste Wine the Master's Way. There'll be a book launch and wine tasting this Friday evening at Magic City Books. One at 7 o'clock and another at 8:15. The tasting is free with the purchase of the book. The book is also available at Amazon. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
I want to show you something. My surgeon walked into my hospital room on Saturday morning, looked at his phone. "How are you?" he said. He shook my left hand. I held his for a moment. "Me? I have a catheter in me. How's your day going? And how did yesterday go?" "Good. It was big," he said. "Let me see if I can find it for you." He found it. My prostate was on his phone. The day before, he performed on me a radical robotic prostatectomy. Translation, he removed my prostate. My marginally cancerous 169-gram prostate, a normal size is about 25 grams, was dislodged from my body through five tiny stiletto-style holes around my abdomen. "You took a picture of it?" I asked. "It looks like a big, bruised, mean orange. Largest one I've ever taken out." "Really?" "Yep." "Wow, do I get a trophy or something?" "Let me not bury the lead. I had beaten cancer," which is a horrid expression, as if I had done something or had some skill or resolve others hadn't. As if even if I had, it would be a good idea to gloat and mock the disease in some kind of post-op end zone dance. "It wasn't as bad as we thought either," he said. "The cancer, I mean. So we probably could have left it in," I said, "since the cancer wasn't so bad." "Don't think like that. It needed to come out. It was doing you no good. Besides, I'm not putting it back." About 165,000 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer every year in America. About 30,000 will die, or to put it another way, 135,000 won't. When you find out that you have cancer, you have to keep finding out you have cancer. Here are my options. I could do nothing, which is what I did the first year, under a protocol called active surveillance, which primarily consists of getting a blood test every few months to check my PSA or prostate-specific antigen. Once cancer is discovered, urologists check for spiking in the PSA, which is problematic, as many things, in fact, cause the PSA to rise, including having the PSA checked. Large prostates also push down on the bladder. Listen to an 11-year-old pee. It sounds like a racehorse is in the bathroom. Listen to a man with a large prostate pee. It sounds like someone is sending Morse code. I could have chosen instead, over a 9-week period and 5 days a week, to have my prostate bombarded by external radiation. But I'd run the risk of cramping, diarrhea, bleeding, having skin the consistency of grilled salmon. There was also something called internal radiation, where 100 radioactive pellets would have been inserted into my prostate between my scrotum and anus, and then I'd need a new wardrobe, because one becomes, wait for it, radioactive. So you must wear lead-free underwear. $180 a pair. A website that sells such underwear reminds you that no returns, which makes infinite sense. Look, I didn't want to set off alarms at airport security and clear children from playgrounds. I wanted it out, separated from me, preferably sitting in a petri dish in a lab somewhere. Once your prostate is out, you get a series of exercises to control your bladder, which means you need pads for the accidents you'll inevitably have. Someone has to buy you these pads, meaning someone you love has to see you this way and buy them for you, meaning someone has to see and buy things for you you don't want them to buy for you and you don't want them to see you wearing. That morning, after the surgeon showed me my prostate on his phone, he also found and played for me Yes's Rick Wakeman's acceptance speech at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This was his acceptance speech. Wakeman is talking. You hear the rubber glove? You feel his fingers, which feel like a hamster on holiday. And then the doctor said, "Mr. Wakeman, there's no need to be embarrassed. It's not unusual to get an erection during this kind of procedure." I said, "Doctor, I don't have an erection." He said, "Yes, I know, but I do." You want prostate jokes? I got prostate jokes. Some of the side effects are changes in penis length. Lovely. I grew a beard. A friend, before having his prostate removed, asked his wife what she thought about the effect it would have on them, especially sexually, for there was no guarantee he'd ever be able to have an erection again. "It's just sex," she said. "It's just sex, and you're my best friend, and I don't want to lose my best friend." Let's go with that.
Barry Friedman is a writer, blogger, and columnist for the Tulsa Voice and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.